All right, this is Landry.audio. Listen, like, and subscribe. Hit the subscribe button on YouTube, little bell icon, which will allow you to stay up to date with what we're doing here today. Today, my guest is Comeback Kid frontman Andrew Neufeld. They're out here, not out here physically in the age of COVID, but they're promoting a new record that's dropping through Nuclear Blast, which is interesting. We'll get to talk to. I know these guys from years ago when we still used to buy physical CDs back in the day. I saw them. I think the only time I've actually seen you play live, Andrew, was back in 2006. I think, if I'm not mistaken, you might have been touring off this Wake the Dead album, and it would have been the Annandale Hotel. And I think at the time, so I was looking at the timeline on Wikipedia, and I don't actually know, because I don't know if you had started fronting the band or if it was still Scott back then. It's probably maybe a good place to start off the conversation, then we'll get into to the new record that you guys are doing.
Yeah, word. I used to play guitar in this band. So we started like 2000 or something, and I played guitar in the band and moved to vocals in 06. Actually, it might have been on that tour. I remember on our way to Australia, our old singer Scott told me, like, that's when he told me, I'm gonna do this Australian tour, and then I'll go down to California with you guys, because we had a tour right after that. He's like, then I'm gonna probably drop off there. So we had a whole another half an American tour going, and then we just kind of didn't ever stop. Like, he went home and I started singing, and we found a fill-in guitar player to take my spot, and it went so fast that it just never stopped. So
yeah, you know, there wasn't a conscious decision, like, you just kind of effectively took it over. There wasn't a debate about bringing someone else in or anything along those lines.
I'd filled in singing, like, I think there was one tour we did, I think it was across Canada, like Bane and Strung Out or something like that. And we were younger and really wanted to take the tour. And then he had to move apartments midway, and we're kind of stubborn. We're like, no, we're doing the tour anyways. So I'd like done it before just as like a fill-in thing. And that was like a couple months before when he actually quit. So like by the time that was happening, it was like, let's just get it. Comeback Kid started as a side project to a band that I used to sing in.
Figure Four.
Figure Four. And so when I started Comeback Kid, I wanted to play guitar in a band, but just with the vocals, I'd always like produced Scott's vocals with him in the studio and worked on lyrics with him and stuff. So, I mean, yes, we could have probably tried to like seek someone out somehow, but it just made the most sense. And here we are 15 years later, and I'm still in it. So.
We're just to, I guess, segue a little bit. I'm a little bit more of a metal guy, so I really enjoy Comeback Kid, but it verges a little bit more into, I guess, puncture territory than some of the other bands I listen to. So Figure Four has a little bit more of a straightforward hardcore sound, and Comeback Kid has more melodies in it. When you were sort of switching over, do you come from that harder edge sound or more the melody based sound?
I got into hardcore through pop, like pop punk, and, you know, just like Propagandhi, even bands like MXPX when I was a baby. I still remember my first time seeing Green Day Dookie video. Right. But so yeah, obviously came from hardcore, from a more pop, you know, punk kind of side. And I know some people will get into hardcore through there, like when they're a kid, they like nu metal or metal or whatever, you know, there's always these different ways to find hardcore. So I always like have melody in my soul, but I kind of hardcore wise, I do gravitate towards like the hardcore, like and traditional hardcore and like New York stuff and just ass beating stuff. But I've been about it. We take some of that harder element and we mix it with the melodic stuff, you know, and so you're going to get kind of both sides of that spectrum with Comeback Kid, because we try to like do different kinds of songs on every record. We're not trying to make like a, you know, we try to make the record ebb and flow, and we realize that sometimes every record's gonna have like a melodic song or more punk leaning song, and then every record's gonna have maybe a more metallic song, or every record's gonna have like a bouncy like mad ball song, you know what I mean? There's all these elements, so we're aware of that, and that's fine. That's what makes it fun for us, just like as songwriters.
What do you think of and I was thinking before we go on, so we would probably be of the same age group. So I'm 40 now. I think I read that you're 38
I'm 40.
Or 30, 40, 40
I'm
now
40.
As well. Okay. So, you know, when you're talking Dookie, I think I was in junior high. We're talking Much Music, probably grew up listening to Strombo do. Well, what was our version of Headbangers Ball up in Canada at the time?
Yeah, that's hell yeah. Strombo interviewed Figure Four one time. We were opening for Hatebreed in Toronto, and he came out and interviewed us. I have a photo somewhere, but
I love Hatebreed. I think they're probably the band I've seen more than anyone because they always open for everyone that I listen to. So I think I've probably seen them, you know, like 15 or 20 times along the road. Where I was going to go with that, because, you know, we'd talk about punk and hardcore. So I think, like, going back then, my first gig that I would have went to would have been like Chicks Dig It, if you remember them. And then Gob was really big around that time as well when I was in high school. What do you think about the other genres that have come off that? And what I said, some of the guys I talked to is things about like deathcore. And I don't know if you go into that, but deathcore has so many of those traditional hardcore breakdowns mixed in with this, like, you know, genty new metal sound and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's cool. I'm not like a huge gent guy, but like, it's cool. You know, I like my sugar and stuff. Isn't that the originators of gent?
I think so. Yeah. Also Nuclear Blast. I think they've been on that label for like 25 years or something.
Yeah, and no hate on it. Like, I like it. It's pretty heavy sometimes. I just don't have my ears stretched out to like this big. So maybe that just kind of veers me off the whole jet path.
Okay, cool. So you guys have just dropped your latest album. It's the second one I've seen with Nuclear Blast. So there's probably some interesting things to talk about your move from Victory over to Nuclear Blast. But how did you guys record right now? I mean, all of you guys are living in different areas of the country. Are you doing this? Are you recording remotely? Are you guys still getting together to do it in person?
Yeah, totally. So like, we live in the band's from Winnipeg, but I'm out in Toronto and three guys are in Vancouver. So right when the pandemic hit, that's when we like, we're like, okay, now we can do the record, because before like March 2020, we were like supposed to go to Asia and like play like Slipknot some festival and then play the Philippines and all these awesome. And then it just looked to be like a crazy, crazy year. And we're like, yeah, we'll like right in between touring. So that would have made this record take even longer, but yeah, we just kind of got down to doing it and kind of gave us like a good purpose during like the whole couple, like the first year of all this shit. And we would just send email stuff back and forth. And it just was doing that, you know, I would get a riff from Jeremy in Winnipeg or Stu in Vancouver. Doing that, I was able, like, I would, you know, even like just mush mouth some lyrics in my room or whatever. I can like kind of scream in there. So, you know, not sometimes it'll be lyrics. Sometimes it won't even be lyrics. It'll just be like a pattern or like a melody. It's like, oh, let's try this out. Then send it back. And they're like, oh, I like that. Or I don't like that. And even with riffs back, I'll also, you know, do some riffs or they'll have some. And we're able to kind of weed through some of it before we got in the room. We'd go to Winnipeg after like, you know, a good few months of this. And we had a couple sessions in Winnipeg where there wasn't even like rehearsal spaces open. So we'd like rent an Airbnb and like secretly jam in the basement. Okay. But that's like, we were able to have like informed rehearsals, you know, like we knew that everyone had like the pile of songs. Okay. And then you were able to weed through some of the songs there and kind of see if it wasn't translating on, you know, with fake drums and like guitars through Logic, maybe sometimes it's going to work in person. And I think like a lot of my songs, I just like, I sometimes just with programming and stuff, I don't have the patience for it sometimes. So I just need to get in the room and be like, just kind of explain it and get like, it takes like 5 seconds if I can explain it. It takes like 2 hours to program the drums, blah, blah, blah. So I like to be in the room, and it's like, I compare it to like, you know, talking to someone online, like flirting with someone online, then being able to actually meet up. There's that different energy. So.
Yeah, right. So I'm not a musician or anything. So is there a substantial difference in, because, you know, going back like a decade or so, I remember, especially in the metal community, everyone talking about doing everything through Pro Tools and like, you know, doing a riff and then looping it and all that. So is that still fairly common, or have, for a lot of bands like yourself, you've gone back to doing everything kind of live in a studio environment?
Oh, I mean, yeah, well, the record's recorded on Pro Tools. Funny enough, we did all our demos on Logic and GarageBand, which is like the Apple one. Yeah. we recorded the record on Pro Tools, and then when Will, we sent it to New York for Will Putney to mix, and he mixed it back on Logic. So right. It's been through a couple different programs, and it's just users, like, kind of just like player's choice when it comes to like what you, how you're going to record. But definitely when you're sending demos back and forth these days, like this time around, there was a lot of like programming drums, putting it in, and then like once we get in the room jamming, the drummer knows what your like idea is already, but then like Lauren, he'll know kind of like what to do, and then you can kind of make the stuff a little more groovy when you're in the room together and kind of explain stuff that maybe you wouldn't be able to pull off when you're like programming it or something, you know.
Yeah. And so where do you think this album fits into your catalog overall? I mean, artists always say, oh, this is definitely our best album. But I mean, I guess when you stack it up against the rest, is there anything that you're hoping to achieve this time around?
I always view every Comeback Kid record, we've had like 7 full lengths. I always view them as a different era in my life. And, you know, every time we have a new record, we work so hard on it. We've been working on this for 2 years. I've had it like in the bag for a half year already. I always think it's the top tier Comeback Kid every time we do a record. I'll tell you what, this is definitely the heaviest Comeback Kid record. Me and Jeremy are the other like guy that founded the band with me. He plays guitar. We have always desired a little bit of a heavier tone. And even you were saying like, we kind of have a little more punk rock leanings. You'll hear in our early records, yes, it's like heavy. But then, you know, we went to go record with Bill Stevenson and Jason Livermore, which are Bill Stevenson's from Descendants. And, you know, he has a studio called The Blasting Room. But so you'd find to have Wake the Dead and Broadcasting on there. And you can tell it's a little bit more of a punk rock tone, maybe some more Marshalls and this, that, the other. And then when we moved to Kyle Black as a producer, which was for a couple later records, we were getting there. And then, but Will Putney, who mixed the last record, he'd like tone zone. He's selling his tones and stuff and everything. Yeah. But it was kind of happy accident. We actually got a bunch of tones in the studio live, and we were okay, kind of cool with it. But in the back of our minds, we're like, okay, there's the possibility to reamp, which is when you'll take the what you've recorded and then play it through an amp again, and then you'll mic it again, but you'll get a different guitar tone.
Right.
Like, okay. So we got a bunch of different guitar tones, and we could shoot it out. Like, okay, here's 4 options. Which one do you like? And so,
yeah. Okay. Cool.
So I think we were really able to achieve a guitar tone that we were looking for, and just a heaviness of the record. We have melodic songs, but it's definitely like heavy, and I'm not afraid of like modern production, you know?
Fair enough. What does that mean for you guys in terms of touring? And I think everyone's really tired of talking about COVID, but I mean, when you're gearing up to play shows and when all you guys are dispersed around the country, how do you do rehearsals and try to prep if you've been, you know, out of commission for a while?
We don't really rehearse.
Right.
I think okay. Well, we just like show up and sound check and then do it. But but when we're rehearsing to jam, we had to like plan out, okay, we're going to Winnipeg for 2 weeks. Let's get that Airbnb and like rehearse in the basement kind of thing. We had like a few sessions like that before we actually recorded the record. Now, to be lucky, we've had 5-6 months of the last of 2021 touring. So we were in the UK, we were in the States. We couldn't really do much in Canada because everything here, but we just avoided it and just went down to the States where we knew it was going to be open. We all got COVID like 3 weeks ago, and we're stuck in like the States during Christmas. We couldn't go home during the holidays, so that was kind of fucked.
Yeah,
but we're okay now. There's a Europe tour that's happening like right now that we had to cancel.
Yeah,
that's what, like I should be in like Germany or something right now, but I'm back in Canada, and our next shows are slated for March, and it seems to be a very, very busy year. It's like, you know, you can postpone things until you know for sure. But it's like, who knows, maybe a new variant's going to come around and then the next show is going to. So right now you just got to take what you can get, make your plans. But if you can, like have like contingency plans to just be able to like pivot and be flexible with it. So
yeah,
and expect the worst. Like, you know, as for small, I couldn't imagine being like these like tiny bands that like you, it's just, it's really daunting. Financially and strategy wise, like planning and time wise, and you know, when you bring like families into the mix and stuff like that, it's like, wow. So you got to be ready for it.
So how big is Comeback Kid as a touring band? Like do you bring a number of roadies with you? Is there a lot of crew that you have to take on board with you?
We have before, like maybe the most amount of people that we've taken on tour with us would be like four. That would be on like a bigger thing. But like for example, like we try to sh like if we if we're doing a tour with Cancer Bats in like next month or whatever, if it happens, and we'll probably share a sound guy with them, and so that's easy. That kind of lightens the load. Sometimes we have a tour manager and a merch person, but sometimes a tour manager can be the merch person as well, you know. Our last tour, we just had like one person out with us.
Yeah,
So
right.
yeah, and especially now with COVID, you want to kind of keep the kind of lighten the load a little bit. And there's a lot of discussions on all the things that are coming up next year of like, hey, like with other bands, let's share like share crew and kind of keep it light.
Keep your overheads low, effectively.
Exactly. Or just at least like the travel party, right?
What has sort of the last 2 years meant for you? I've spoken to a couple of other bands that, you know, that aren't stadium big, and they're like, man, we've had to go back and get, you know, regular jobs. We've been sitting around on the sidelines waiting because gigging is how they make their living. How has it sort of impacted you guys?
100%. Well, like I said, like we started writing right at the beginning of the pandemic. And so that kind of gave us purpose. For the first bit, not too much work going on. But then, you know, I started shifting into working in film, and like I was like doing location man, like helping my brother that he does location. He's a location manager on commercials. And then I would do like driving, like for like I drive like cast and crew on movies and shit like that. And I know the other guys definitely were like doing like Uber Eats and this, that, the other, and you know. So, but having the record gave us, well, A, we got a budget from Nuclear Blast to record, so that's kind of sick. And it just kind of gave us like a purpose and like on a goal. And that's why we got the record done about 10 months ago, and then we were like, okay, like let's get to the States. And like so last summer, your winter, it was on for us. Like we've just the last 6 months, it's been go, 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 and like just trying to get it in as much as we could where it's like actually happening, you know.
Yeah, cool. Okay. Where to move the conversation from? So, you're from Winnipeg originally. We spoke about this very briefly, and I saw in another interview. I mean, you mentioned that you don't watch a lot of hockey, but it's sort of ingrained in Canadian culture. As I mentioned, I'm from there originally. Many years ago, the Jets were sold off to Minnesota, who became the Wild, and Winnipeg didn't have a team for a long time. And in another interview, you were mentioning like culturally, just the revival that went through the city of Winnipeg when hockey returned there. Tell us about that because I fundamentally understand what that is, but you know, it's kind of living in a major Canadian
I
city
mean,
without a
okay,
team.
we, you know, being from growing up with the Winnipeg Jets, it's, you know, we have our hockey team, and you know, Winnipeg's been pretty far from the rest of the world. Like our the closest American city that's like kind of popping is Minneapolis. So I used to drive as a kid to Minneapolis for shows, and it's like an 8 hour drive, right? So but to have like a national team was really fucking cool, like, and something to take pride in. And I think they got sold to Vegas, if I'm not mistaken. And so just for like 10 years, or I don't know, 15 years, like there was always hope maybe the Jets are gonna come back. And like, you know, when they finally did, the city went wild, and you know those like street parties where everyone's like, yeah, whatever. And actually I think that the main paper of the city, Winnipeg Free Press, there was like a guy like and he had the Comeback Kid shirt because it almost looks like it's a Jets ripoff shirt, but it doesn't, but it says Comeback Kid. So I'm glad we haven't gotten that cease and desist yet, but
Well, I mean, and it's funny because it says like I don't follow hockey that much, but and then if I'm not mistaken, the actual band name is influenced by the return of Mario Lemieux after his back problems, which is do I have that correct?
The Comeback Kid, yeah. It was just like a headline in the paper, and it said like, you know, the Comeback Kid. And we were looking for names. I had a lot of shitty names, and that one seemed like the one. And yeah. It hasn't aged too bad. I think we're still in a decent place for it. So
yeah, fair. So do you guys still consider, you know, there's a lot of bands that start in a place and then they move out of there, but do you guys still, I guess, consider yourself classically like a Winnipeg based band then?
Yeah, we kind of rep that, and you know, our business is licensed there, and that's where my actual home is, you know.
Yeah, fair enough. And what's so as I mentioned, I grew up out west in Vancouver and in Calgary, and I always heard this reputation about Winnipeg. It's sort of like two things. First of all, is the massive dumps of snow that they would get overnight. So you get like 40 centimeters of snow overnight. But also apparently Winnipeg has a what we would call bike year, like really big biker culture. And apparently it's like Quebec and Winnipeg have some of the largest areas for like bikey wars and all those sorts of things out there.
Well, you know what's it's crazy because when I go back there. Especially in the summertime, you're right. It wasn't like that when I was living there. But now it's just like crazy, like lots of bike trails. Like they've really stepped it up, and it's quite awesome. If you like have a bike there, you can go so many different places. So I'm curious to kind of explore that more if I have a chance to get back there.
Yeah, cool.
But I actually like moved away in 2008 or something. Because I had a girlfriend from Byron Bay in Melbourne, and and I was like, yo, there's no chance that she's gonna want to like live in Winnipeg. And so she flew out in like February. It was minus 40. We got in a van and we drove to Toronto. And like, yeah.
So only because you segue there, it was so I think Parkways from Byron, which is right up on the northern coast of New South Wales. I think you've done a few tours with them in the past. And again, I'm 40 now, so I'm not a scenester or anything. I just kind of listen to the bands that I know, and I'm introduced to other bands. But you know,
what's wrong with being a scenester at 40?
Nothing. I just got two kids, and I'm trying to stay afloat and pay the bills. That's all. So you know, you do what you can as you get older. Yeah. There's probably a cool couple places to move there. But I didn't realize how massive Parkway Drive had become. They were, I don't know if they're at, but you know, maybe about 5 years ago, it was like they were the band on the scene. I saw them as like the headline band for most European festivals. And I had no idea that they were that big. And I assume that you know them quite well. So it's interesting for me to see an Australian band at that sort of level internationally.
Totally. Our first time coming to Australia, we played Byron Bay, and we played in the like Parkway Drive guys like basement. And so there's like 10 of them, you know, shirtless dudes and a few girls in there. Like, yeah. We just played for them in the basement. This would have been again like 2004 or something like that. And then you know, when they first started coming to the States, I remember there was one tour, they were one of five on our tour. We were paying them out of our own guarantee.
Yeah.
Actually, our bass player at the time, Kevin, married the drummer's sister, and he lives out in Gold Coast right now, I believe, or Byron or Brizzy. Okay. Or something.
Yeah.
So there's that connection. And then, you know, they just started getting higher and higher on bills. And then they surpassed us like tons of bands do. And now they're like festival headliners. I know like our booking agent in Europe books them. And I remember he was telling me about a show one time where it was like, I don't know, I think it was Metallica or something. And he like put Parkway on as the deadliner after, like they just wanted, I'd never heard that term before, but I guess Metallica had to be done by a certain time. So there's another stage and they referred to it as a deadliner. And after that, like if everyone stayed and just after that, I think it just somehow like carried over this, like they're like the new big metal band.
Yeah. It was,
you know, and it's bigger than ever. And I wonder if, seeing it explode in Australia, like it's the same with Amity Affliction in Australia. I think it's when the rest of the world sees a band like explode in Australia and become an arena band there, does it almost like somehow translate into like other parts of the world, you know? So
yeah, I don't know. The other band that I'm really into that seems to be getting enormous is Thy Art Is Murder, but they're more into that, you know, very, very sort of heavy.
I like Thy Art Is Murder. So, yeah. I like those guys a lot.
Mm. Yeah. Interesting. All right, where did I want to go with this? I was sort of sitting in the pocket and go, I don't know what I'm going to ask next. The probably a good place, good, is You know, you guys come from a hardcore label. So, you know, you mentioned Parkway, who are, I think, primarily signed to Resist over here. I've got a lot of bands from Victory Records, but this is your second one with Nuclear Blast. So it's interesting to me because, you know, Victory is traditionally a hardcore label, and I know Nuclear Blast for a lot of the more traditional, you know, European-based heavy metal bands I listen to. But it seems like Nuclear Blast has really gotten big over the last, you know, sort of 10 years. So do you want to kind of give us a bit of an insight in what that means in changing label? I mean, is that a decision by your manager? Do you shop a new deal? Do they come to you? How do you decide, and what are they offering to you for you to say, okay, yeah, we're ready to, you know, make a change?
Yeah, for sure. So we're one of the rare bands that actually like got through our Victory contract. I think we did 4 records with them. So, and that took about 15 years, I want to say, 14 years to do 4, you know. So it was a long relationship, and, you know, they have some pretty funny stories you've heard about Victory. But they really like exploited our band at one point, when, especially when the Wake the Dead record came out. I mean, that was a huge moment for us. And, it's always been a gradual growth. And, so we fulfilled our contract with them, and then we were searching for a new label. A couple came to the table, you know, some American labels. There was one particular American label that it was pretty much going to go between the American label and Nuclear Blast. And I think at the time we were feeling like Europe was where we were making most of our, having like kind of most of the success, and it was going the best. So, and a lot of festivals in Europe and stuff. So, and that really kind of became a big part of like our touring, is like focusing on the, always doing the festivals in the summer and that, and just probably spring. And we just felt like having a label like Nuclear Blast that has such a presence, especially in Europe, would be the right move. And so that's kind of how it went. And, you know, they've kind of even gone through changes while we've been on the label. They sold their company to a digital distribution company called Believe. Right. And, you know, with both, like with all labels, it's like what you're able to do with a label is just access different people to help you with things that you can't do yourself. I mean, yes, they make records for you, but they can also help with some of the digital stuff and making assets, especially now with all the visual side of the band that you have, we have to do. Yeah. So you just get, help with, you know, the Spotify's and just like little things that it's good to have a team that you can kind of rely on. And so that's been kind of where our head's been at with that. And it's cool, you know, and like, we organized this interview or a podcast with Australian publicist. And I have someone in the US doing one, and someone in Europe doing some. So it's quite a few people from around the world. And we just kind of like manage ourselves, but that's all on the label side. And then as far as management stuff, we just outsource people. Like I get people to help with some business management stuff with the numbers and some of that. And we have booking agents in different territories. So there's a lot of cooks in the kitchen there.
Fair enough. I always like, because again, I think we're sort of the same age. So growing up, I remember buying CDs and tapes, and then, you know, with Napster and everything, that went out the window. And I'm always curious how sort of bands survive now, because you hear so much sort of negative feedback on the deals that are being done through Spotify and how that money doesn't really reach artists. But a couple of years ago, I spoke with Brian Slagle, who's the CEO of Metal Blade Records. And he was saying like, we're doing better now than we ever had before. We've been able to organize these contracts with artists. But I think there seems to be sort of a combination of both the recording, the touring, and the merchandising now, where labels are all tied in together and you're trying to maximize your earnings off of that. Can you just help us sort of understand? Because normally it used to just be go buy the CD, buy a t-shirt, go see the band on tour. And that still seems to be the case, but I'm just kind of wondering underneath there, how do you kind of survive through all this these days?
I think generally the way that most bands make their money is like touring. So playing shows and merch, and then online merch stores. And then depends what their deal is as far as like publishing, and if you're, you know, if you're getting sync stuff, like hardcore heavier music doesn't really, I don't generally see it make tons of money off that. But an interesting conversation, I was talking about publishing recently with a lawyer that's helping us out, and he was saying that the thing with like heavy music is, okay, so that has really been highlighted, especially now during the pandemic, is, okay, say in the physical days, a band sold a million records. They probably have a million fans, right? Nowadays, and it's been highlighted with the pandemic, you could have maybe 100,000 fans or 150, and probably see the same numbers of things of stream. But they're all listening to your record 10 times or 100 times, and so that adds everything up to more streams and stuff. And
yeah, okay.
It is kind of funny because I don't really see, like, I've never really seen money from streams, this, that, the other. But on the flip side of it, I get paid, like, we'll get money to record a record, or a budget to record a record. So that's not like always like the smallest chunk of change. So, you know, they have to recoup the fees for, you know, making the records.
Yeah.
And it's all a lot, man. You know, I'm just here to, you asked if I have any hobbies and stuff. Like, I'm not doing math, that's for sure. I'm trying. And when I do, I get the wrong numbers. So I don't know.
Do you mentioned international touring. I've always sort of considered hardcore as a very American product. So when you think of like Black Flag and Madball, do you find a difference in scenes or overall attitudes when you travel to different areas of the world?
Totally. America's the big dogs, the tough dogs. People in Europe, I maybe are a little bit more reserved but loyal. We love going to South America and Southeast Asia because it's wild style and people are climbing up on stage. I mean, America, like our last tour, to be fair, actually, we just did the West Coast, and that was wild style too. Like, I just have been loving moshing for a living again and having people fucking grab me and stage dive and shit. Like, I'm about it. So I think people are hungry for music right now, but especially, you know, in the past, maybe America's harder to win over, but maybe now after the pandemic, people are amped again. So like, they're ready for it.
Ready to get out there and see. And I kind of consider you guys a bit of a crossover band. So I assume with the tours that you go into, you're probably playing some venues that are more geared to audiences that are pop punk, traditional hardcore, and then metal. Have you always found that you've gotten a good reception across the board? Have you always found certain audiences a little bit more difficult to break through to?
I think that is one of our strengths, even though I don't sometimes feel like we always fit in certain like parts of like the hardcore scene or whatever. Maybe that's a strength because we can go on tour with like 4 Years Strong or Rise Against or Dropkick Murphys and have a cool reaction, Bad Religion. And then we can also go on tour with, you know, we played shows with, like you said, like Thy Art Is Murder, or we played shows with Parkway, or, you know, some more metal leaning bands, and have great shows. You know, this next year, we're going to go, or, you know, probably not this year, but I think we're, you know, there's talks of doing like a NoFX festival run, and then we're trying to get like a Gojira run, you know. So there's these sides of the fence that these are literally talked about tours, but, you know, not but realistic stuff. Then that's the kind of thing that happens with us. We do play with a lot of more bands that are more melodic than us. Now that I think about it, it's like, we went to South America with Pennywise. We've toured like four continents with Propagandhi. So we do like that stuff, but there's always, we do play with a lot of heavy bands too.
Yeah, because I've always found it, well, at least in the circles that I travel in, there seems to be a very defining line. It's like I'm not too much into stuff like like Green Day and Pennywise and NoFX and that sort of stuff, but as soon as you cross over into, you know, DRI and that sort of stuff, I'm I'm game for it. So I was always sort of curious because there really seems to be a defining line between a lot of kids that won't really cross over beyond that sort of punk stuff, like Descendants and that sort of thing.
We definitely have to win people over sometimes if maybe they don't know, but I like that feeling of being able to win a band over, a crowd over. I would love to tour, like you were talking about some crossover stuff. Like I would love to tour with Municipal Waste. We've just played once or twice with them at festivals, or we played a show in France with them somewhere. And again, I felt like it was a moment where like we won them over because it was just like it was a banging show. So, and it was really wild. So
I've been listening to all this like thrash from the late 80s and 90s again, because I'm on Reddit, and as I said, you know, that you stick to the traditional stuff. And so you mentioned Municipal Waste, like Toxic Holocaust, and all these guys are pulling out these bands that are on, like, you know, Brutal Assault and Demolition Hammer and all this stuff that I initially overlooked, but it's just absolutely, you know, raging thrash metal that seems to be really influenced by stuff like Cryptic Slaughter back in sort of like the mid 80s. And it's totally cool to be reintroduced to music that you missed that's 30 years old.
You should check out the best Canadian thrash band ever called Razor.
I know Razor. They've been on the playlist too. Sacrifice has been in there as well.
Oh, hell yeah. And I've been listening. I think Violence has a new record out, but I kind of revisit. It's pretty fucking brutal. So I like that shit. And we have a little bit of that influence too. So, you know, we like, it's, there's a lot of different styles of fast beat that are going on. And, you know, we got...
Yeah, well, the scene, like when I was in Calgary, the two bands that used to come through all the time were Cataclysm and Cryptopsy out of Quebec. They were kind of like the ones that we came through. But I can only think of more like Strapping Young Lad, and then I suppose it gets pretty mainstream with bands like, you know, Headstones and Tragically Hip, and as I said, like Chicks Dig It and Gob and that sort of
thing. I'll tell you a couple funny things just based on what you just said. The last drummer that we had, his name is Jesse. He plays in the Headstones now, which is funny.
Yeah.
And also Devin Townsend sang on our previous record, and he produced a record for my other band, Sights and Sounds. So big fans of that list that you just
cool.
kind of spouted out here.
All right. Well, look, we're probably starting to run out of time. We'll begin to wrap it up. I guess a couple more questions for you. Tell us a little bit about touring and the significant differences. So we know, like in America and Europe, you get in your van, within an hour, you're in the next major city. You know, as I said, growing up in Canada, I live in Australia, we're virtually the same. You got to drive 8 to 10 hours to get to the next place. What sort of pressures does that put on you of you know, trying to tour and make a life for yourself when you got to drive a day to get to the next venue and kind of aligning where you're going to go in these sorts of economies where cities are so desperately far away from each other?
We don't really tour Canada very often, to be honest with you. When we do, it's an event, like once every year or two. We'll do like probably once every two to three years, to be honest with you, we'll do like a cross Canada thing. But we just try to like pack it into 2 weeks and do it as quick as possible. There's a lot of overnight drives. And it's definitely harder to convince when you're trying to put together a package. It's harder to convince American bands to come up to Canada because of the drives. And they can kind of do the same type of thing and have way shorter distance commutes in the States. So, but every time it's us living in different cities in Canada, it's almost like every show is like a kind of a hometown
or something like that.
Every show is a hometown show. Like there's family in like literally every city between the, like the five of us. It's, you know, we have Vancouver, then Alberta, Winnipeg, and I'm in Toronto. So it's like, between where we live and where we're from, that's quite a fam jam situation.
Fair enough. I found out, I assume that you would probably at least know them if you haven't toured with them. I found out the other week, Every Time I Die has broken up as a band. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, they were also another sort of Victory staple where I've got, you know, a few albums there that they were around for about 20 years as well.
They were on Ferret back in the day, which was another like label of that time, the mid-2000s. That's where they were kind of like, I think they got their big start. They may have moved around. We toured with them, actually our third tour ever was with Every Time I Die, Terror, and Throwdown or something. This is back
sounds
in
like a great
2004 bill. Or five. And then we actually recently toured with them in, I want to say like 2017 or 18, we toured with them in Europe and the UK. So we've had our, I don't really know them too well, but we've been around. We've been around lots of festivals and stuff. Yeah.
And this will be the last question I ask you for today. So I appreciate your time.
Hell yeah. Appreciate you.
Oh, thank you. You know, we're not getting any younger, and it's interesting to watch a lot of the bands that I grew up with now. You know, watching, you know, guys from like the big four, like Metallica and Megadeth take the stage. And I think, again, it was probably many years ago I saw Metallica, but when they were playing live, they seemed behind the beat. It seemed like they were struggling to keep up and play their songs. What's in this for you, do you think? Do you think you can continue to do this into the senior years, or is there sort of a game plan for where you think this goes over time?
To be honest, there's no game plan for like shutting down. We feel quite invigorated, and also I lost 40 pounds in the last like year. I'm looking back at photos of myself from the last like 5 to 10 years, and I'm like, dude, there's some moments where it was like rough. So I'm feeling a bit light as a feather these days, and a little faster on stage. But yeah, dude, you gotta like be aware of that stuff. And when it dips, when the crowd dips, like, I mean, maybe that's when we'll be having those conversations, but it feels right now like I'm stage diving again, I'm moshing again, I'm out here. So like that you were talking about, you know, that you were having the kids, and I'm just kind of ready to go.
Fair enough. Well, look, I hope it all goes well for you. I mean, normally say we'll see you on tour, but we don't really know what that situation is like at the moment. But
you will. Hopefully next year.
All right, awesome. Well, thanks for your time, Andrew. I think you got a couple more of these to do, so I hope the evening goes well for you.
Thank you so much, my man.
All right. Cheers. Bye-bye.
See ya.